But now the time, it's 7 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3. It's over to, I'm sure, a busy Royal Albert Hall for this evening's prom to join Susie Klein.
Thanks very much indeed, Sean. Yes, a warm welcome to the Royal Albert Hall. Tonight, the BBC National Orchestra of Wales is back at the proms after a double stint here over the weekend when they performed two Doctor Who proms, one performance Saturday night, one on Sunday morning, featuring a variety of intergalactic music. They were also, by the way, here last Thursday night with Britten, Prokofiev, Shostakovich. Anyway, they've had a few hours to rest, to rehearse and reset as they focus on an altogether different musical programme. Tonight they are here with principal conductor Thierry Fischer, launching this season's cycle of complete Schumann symphonies here at the proms, and a performance of Schumann's youthful, effervescent first symphony. Music with no less oomph to close tonight's concert, Strauss's Merry Prankster, Till Eulenspiegel is on the bill. And Simon Holt's percussion concerto, A Table of Noises, receives its London premiere tonight. It was specially written for our soloist, Colin Currie. We'll be hearing from both him and the composer, Simon Holt, a little later. And we open, rather appropriately, with an overture. It's from Cherubini's most popular opera, Médée, written in 1797 and with one of the most gruesome plots in the whole repertoire. The title character is the infamous woman of Greek myth, Medea, a sorceress who at the end of this opera murders her own children. In the lead up to that, she also kills her brother, and as her father's chasing her out of town, she dismembers said sibling, scattering his body parts as she goes, so that Dad has to stop pursuing her in order to give each body part a decent burial. Not exactly the kind of woman you want to get stuck next to on the train, really. Anyway, here to perform the overture from Cherubini's gruesome operatic extravaganza, Médée, the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, and conductor Thierry Fischer.
Thank you.
from Cherubini's opera Medea. That was the overture, the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Thierry Fisher. The leader, Leslie Hatfield. And it's on now to the next piece on this evening's programme, and Schumann's First Symphony, composed in 1841. It's surprising in some ways that he ever bothered to write one at all. It was only 6 years earlier than this that Schumann had pronounced, rather inaccurately as it turned out, that henceforth the term symphony belongs to the past. Well, the gloomy prediction was entirely understandable. After Beethoven, there seemed to be no one either talented or brave enough to take on the mantle of the next great symphonist. And as it turned out, it was Schubert who proved to be the key to the future. After his death, his C major symphony had been collecting dust for years. It was hidden in a sheaf of papers. Schumann discovered the score while visiting the composer's estate. He was stunned by it. He showed it to Mendelssohn, who immediately organised a premiere, and the symphonic torch was lit again. Well, Schumann soon began writing his own new piece. It was a joyful, fizzing symphony, brimming with ideas, and it was no accident that the music of this period, so around the early 1840s, was so blisteringly sunny. After years of bitter opposition from his former teacher, Friedrich Wieck, Schumann had finally married Wieck's daughter, Clara. She was just 20 years old, but already she was one of the most famous concert pianists in Europe, a formidable player, clearly also one of the most beguiling women of her age. She and Schumann's was one of the great love affairs of its time, and the result was an almost constant outpouring of music from him. This symphony, for instance, completed in a blaze of creativity. Almost unbelievably, the first draft of this symphony was written in just 4 days. And so, here to perform Schumann's First Symphony here at the Proms, Thierry Fisher, BBC National Orchestra of Wales.
Thank you.
Schumann's Spring Symphony, the Symphony No. 1. BBC National Orchestra of Wales, their leader, Leslie Hatfield, and the principal conductor, Thierry Fischer. And that performance launching this proms Schumann Symphony cycle, celebration of the composer's bicentenary, 2010. We've already heard at this year's Proms Piano Concerto, that was last night. Next to come, in just a couple of days' time, is the third symphony, the Rhenish. That'll be performed by the BBC Symphony Orchestra under conductor Oliver Nusson. And if you want to find out more about Schumann, there is a great piece that I'd love to recommend to you by Stephen Johnson. It's in this year's Proms Guide. It's called A Mind Unhinged or A Genius Unlocked. Well worth a look. I have to say, this symphony is not quite new to Thierry Fischer and this orchestra. In spring this year, they took it on tour around North Wales, Aberystwyth, Wrexham, Llandudno. And Thierry told me earlier that it's not always easy coming back to a work after a few months away from it. Every concert, every change of venue, even tiny changes in the makeup of the orchestra, a change of player here or there, makes it a different experience, a different challenge every time. Well, it is time now at the Royal Albert Hall for this evening's interval. Still to come tonight, a recent work from the British composer Simon Holt, a percussion concerto inspired by a taxidermist. Stay tuned to find out more about that. And we've Richard Strauss's romping orchestral fantasy, Till Eulenspiegel. That all starts in around 20 minutes' time here on Radio 3. First, though, we are off to New York for our interval feature, The Bear, a delightfully odd tale about the personal sacrifices people make to conform. It's by the award-winning League of Gentlemen writer Jeremy Dyson.
It was in 2005, the year of his father's death, that Daniel Scheer finally went to the ball. It was a biennial event his company held at the Tavern on the Green. Daniel was not a native New Yorker. He was, in fact, from New Zealand. But he loved Central Park, and he loved the tavern, and more than anything, he loved the fact that he was now a partner at Askey and Bryant, and therefore invited to the partners' ball. He was at home. He'd found his place. The ground was solid, and there he stood. The ball was traditionally held on the 11th of November, Veterans Day. The original Mr. Bryant had lost two sons in the Second World War, and the event was established partly in their memory. For Daniel, this was an inconvenience. He would have liked to pick his costume up as late as possible, given that the revelation of who was wearing what contributed much to the impression created on the night. But Tuesday was a public holiday, and the store would be closed. This meant he would have to collect his outfit today. He wished he had completed the chore sooner. He had overlooked its importance. A conversation in the men's room with J.T. McNeil had convinced him that this had been a mistake. Scheer, partner-in-law, how does that feel? Pretty good, sir, pretty good. JT, said JT, looking up briefly. Pretty good, JT, Daniel smiled as he unzipped. In time for the ball, too. Want some advice? JT shook himself vigorously, concentrating intently on the action as he spoke. Love it, said Daniel. Make an impression. People will remember what your costume is. So choose something memorable You get me? Thank you, JT. I will. Nothing too self-conscious, but something with wit, with taste, with balls. Well, I understand. My first year as partner, I came as Judge Roy Bean. Thought I was being clever. Nobody knew who I was, which was very telling. 2 years after, I went as King Kong. Never looked back after that. Daniel had settled on the idea of a gladiator. His legs were strong and would look good in skirt and sandals. There was a level of fun, of irony, that would neatly disguise any macho subtext. Plus, Sasha would be able to wear something suitably alluring to complement it. There would be many reasons to envy Daniel, all on clear display. His youth, his vigour, his partner, virtually every aspect of his life. What would Dad have thought of this? No way of telling him now. But he had known where Daniel was heading. He would have taken that knowledge to the grave. Daniel shook his head. Such thoughts were indecent. He had loved his father. They were different, that's all. He walked down Lexington Avenue, savouring the crispness of the November evening. He risked a glance at his watch. He started walking faster. The store closed, eccentrically, he thought, at 5:45 p.m. There had never been fancy dress parties in his youth. His friends had conjurers, puppet shows, long games of cricket in the Auckland Sun. What did Dad organise for him? Reading parties, poetry and stories. Daniel had been ashamed, embarrassed, sickened at his difference from everybody else. Immersed in the university, his father could see no wrong in this version of a good time. What mattered now? What mattered was this. The reality of the broad Manhattan pavement beneath Daniel's feet, the money in his pocketbook, in his bank. This was Daniel's reality, and he had sewn it for himself, stitch by laboured stitch. Taking a left turn, he noticed the elegance and neatness of the shop front start to become more chaotic. Strange. He had never thought it before, and yet, when he glanced up at the rooms above the awnings, he was surprised to see pastel shades and little balconies, just like Mission Bay back home. He searched among the signage and the window displays. There it was. The Gramercy Costume and Novelty Store. Looking at his watch again, Daniel crossed the road. Somewhere, an old-fashioned bell tinkled musically. Daniel glanced around the small premises, which seemed shabby and antiquated. Though beneath his urgency, he perceived a dim sense of pleasure, too. It was a shop he would have loved as a child, full of the kind of vulgar delights that were taboo in the Shear household. He shook his head as if to dispel a clouding thought. He didn't have time. Behind the counter was a large old man in a cardigan and check shirt. A little black boy stood absorbed in a demonstration of a magic trick. "Watch it. Watch it," said the man. It sounded like a warning, but he was talking to the boy. The old man swirled three walnut shells around a black foam rubber mat. "That one," said the boy, when the old man's fingers had come to a rest. With an emphatic gesture, the old man inverted the chosen shell, revealing nothing but emptiness underneath. His old baggy face broke out into a huge smile. "Pick again." Daniel chose this moment to cough noisily. "Which one do you think?" said the old man, theatrically oblivious to Daniel's presence. "Think carefully." The little boy stared at the two remaining inverted shells.
"Excuse me. We heard you already,"
shouted the old man without looking up.
"That one," said the boy,
content with whatever reasoning had led him there.
"Aha,"
said the old man, delighted. He flipped up the shell, and there was nothing beneath.
"Now which one?"
"Now you're being silly," said the little boy.
He pointed to the last remaining walnut shell.
"Well, see for yourself," said the old man.
The little boy reached out and flipped it up. Nothing but emptiness.
"No way, where is it?"
"Who knows?"
The old man shrugged his shoulders in an exaggerated manner. Daniel felt he had to interrupt. "I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to insist that you serve me." The old man turned his full attention to Daniel. Daniel was surprised to feel himself shrink a little.
"Pretty sure of yourself, aren't you?" said the old man. "Patience is a virtue. You know that, don't you?"
Daniel didn't say anything. He took out his wallet and opened it, allowing the thick sheaf of bills within to show.
"You mind?" said the old man to the young boy, his voice noticeably softening.
"I guess not," said the child.
"Well, maybe we can go ahead and see what the gentleman wants. Now then, sir, how may we serve?"
My assistant called earlier, reserved a costume. Share's the name."
"Share, share," said the old man, searching his memory as he spoke the surname aloud. "Share," he said again, which began to make it sound abstract, the repetition emptying it of meaning. "Share."
"Sure," said Daniel again.
"Share. Yeah, yeah. Gladiator, was it?"
"Gladiator, yes."
"Ain't got one."
"I beg your pardon?"
"Ain't got one. Sorry."
The old man looked at Daniel unapologetically. "I paid a deposit."
"That right," said the old man.
"That's right," said Daniel. "And contracts just can't be broken on a whim. Now, I need a gladiator costume by tomorrow night, and I expect you to provide me with one."
"Expect away," said the old man. "Ain't got one here."
"Well, I'm not leaving the shop until you hand it over."
"Bully for you. Gets pretty cold in here nights. We'll see you Wednesday."
Daniel tried to take charge of his rage. If he left the shop without an outfit, he would have approximately 20 minutes to find another costume store. It was not a smart play to let this matter slide out of his control. He took a deep breath. "Do you think I might be able to browse? Choose something for myself?"
"Browse?"
The old man raised his eyebrows, considering the matter. And after a moment came the reply.
"Nope. Costumes are stored downstairs. Ain't got no liability insurance for downstairs. If you were to slip on the stairs, well, I guess you'd be able to sue my ass off."
He looked at Daniel and sniffed noisily.
"So, nope. Can't really let you browse."
"Well, how might we best resolve this? The matter of me choosing... my choice of costume." The old man sniffed again.
"Well, I reckon I've got just what you need," he said eventually. "Masquerade ball, is it? Professional function?"
"Yes," said Daniel, feeling a rising sense of panic.
"You want to make an impression, then? Something people ain't likely to forget."
A moment, and then Daniel said, "Yes." His only option was to surrender.
"Yep, I reckon I got just the outfit," said the man, smiling for a second time.
The weight of the thing was extraordinary. Came in its own bespoke canvas bag. Daniel struggled back up towards Lexington Avenue, searching for the promise of a taxi light. At first, Daniel had been disappointed. The thing looked mangy, dirty even, but the old man had brushed the fur. Then he produced the jewelled waistcoat and decorative collar. The sense of grandeur, of specialness, was striking, offset by the uniqueness and charm of the outfit itself. Daniel's initial disappointment was replaced by a rising excitement.
"You'll need someone to help you into it."
"I have someone."
"And help you out. Not easy to get out once you're in."
"That's all right."
"You sure now?"
"Quite sure."
"'Cause I wouldn't rent this baby out to just anyone. She needs appreciation."
"I understand." The old man studied Daniel for a moment, clearly thinking. Whatever it was he was thinking about remained inscrutable.
"Take her then," he said after a moment. "Gergesundheit."
The traffic was ghastly, and Daniel decided to walk the last 2 blocks home, even though he had the costume to carry. He got there exhausted, sweating and overheated, despite the cold November evening.
"Where have you been?" said Sasha.
"I just need to stash this.
tried not to sound out of breath. The costume? She looked at the ridiculously large bag. Have you got the chariot in there as well? He had already had thoughts about how to address the matter of her outfit. The change of hairstyle and some creative accessorizing, it would not be hard to transform her into a gypsy maid to his performing bear. Sasha turned on the overhead lights in order to appreciate its splendour fully. The fur was a very dark brown, almost black. It did not look fake, more like the coat of a real animal. It exuded a faint smell, not unpleasant, but sharp and pungent. A touch of straw, a hint of earth. Its mouth contained teeth and a plump, sculpted tongue. The glazed claws looked like they could scratch a wound in skin. Most impressive was its scale. The thing must have been nearly 7 feet from toe to ear. Its feral nature was offset by the delicate and elaborate clothing it sported. Sasha reached down to touch the material with her fingers. Look how beautifully it's made. Built to value rather than a cost, said Daniel, a phrase his father used when talking about architecture. It took them both some time to work out how to get into it. The whole thing was constructed so that when viewed from the outside, there were no seams, joins, or zippers visible. The illusion of a living, breathing animal was complete. The heavy head itself unscrewed, like the lid of a jar. Once within it, the occupant would be unable to release himself, however. There were two small latches that had to be unclipped, buried in the fur. A difficult task, even with the full use of one's fingers. Wow, said Sasha. She drew an elegant painted nail over one of the buckles. Daniel leaned closer. There were inscriptions etched into the metalwork. What do they say? Sasha studied them. I don't know if they're words. What then? Runes? Hieroglyphics? She let the buckle go, began working at the fastenings. In the end, they managed to get Daniel into it by laying the whole thing on the bathroom floor. Oh, yes, said Sasha. We like. She encouraged him to walk a few steps towards her. He moved, haltingly at first, then with more confidence. It was heavy, but something about the design of the buckles and the straps, the way they distributed the load, made the weight bearable. Sasha led Daniel to the mirror. Although his field of vision was reduced, he could see well enough through the band of gauze in the bear's neck. He stood in front of the mirror and admired himself. Is that Daniel? Daniel Scher? The word had got around already. Daniel raised a paw. He found the laughter and wonder that the costume was unfailingly being greeted with truly gratifying. Nobody would forget this debut. He walked carefully through the tavern on the Green's crystal room, managing, just about, to slip carefully between chairs and tables so as not to dislodge any plates or drinks. Here was Mr. Bryant Jr., Herb, as Daniel was now entitled to call him. He felt something like pride rising within, that they might have a natural moment together, unsought by Daniel, yet surely inevitable. Who could pass the bear and not say something? I hear the Daniel Shares somewhere in there. Good evening, Herb. He felt his heart race. But why shouldn't he use the name? That was the truth of his position now. Excellent show. Just what we want to see from the new blood. He felt a hand patting the bear's shoulder. Thank you, said Daniel. His gratitude was heartfelt. Daniel's plan was to make it to a row of seats he had spotted in the terrace room, just to have a few moments' rest before going on to Sasha at the bar. The costume was heavy, and though the bracing was comfortable, he was beginning to feel a strain in his calves and his upper back, pain in muscles that were receiving unfamiliar exertion. Scher! An enthusiastic cry from a phantom of the opera, its face divided by a white plastic mask. It was hard to associate the chin and lips with anyone he knew. Mouth leaned close to his gauze, muttered these words. You are an embarrassing Kiwi prick. An embarrassment to this firm. The phantom was gone. Daniel felt the sting. He hadn't anticipated it. Hadn't been able to steel himself. He stumbled on. There were the chairs up ahead. The heaviness was part of him now, had found its way into him. Suddenly, it was becoming impossible to bear. He had to sit down. The spot was quiet, set back from the fray. Everything looked distant, the lights diffused by the heavy gauze. He sat back, grateful for the support of the chair, though still feeling the weight in his shoulders, in his neck. The night was cool and clear. It looked like it would be fun just to walk among the greenery on the edge of the park, take a carriage ride perhaps, stroll unburdened in the crisp, fresh air. This was not an option for him. The air in the costume seemed to compress. He felt the heat of it pressing against his eyes. Sasha found him slumped slightly, leaning against a plaster column.
"I thought you were coming to find me."
She looked down at him. He was very still. Was he asleep? She wouldn't be surprised. He'd been working very hard. This event was the apotheosis of everything he'd been pushing towards his whole life. She rapped gently on the fierce, heavy head.
"Daniel!"
He didn't respond.
"Daniel!"
she shouted through the gauze. The bear didn't move. Now she began to feel a little hook of panic, tugging at her gut. Trying to control her fingers, Sasha reached round the neck, searching for the little securing latches. Having done so, she twisted at the head, holding onto the ears like handles. "I'm coming in, honey!" Nothing prepared Sasha for what she found inside, which was nothing. The costume was empty. The buckles still buckled. The fastenings still tight. At first, Sasha assumed this was a joke, an elaborate joke that Daniel must have arranged with a friend from work. But in her heart, she knew this couldn't be the case. There was no one Daniel was close enough to with whom he could have made such an arrangement. Daniel's share was never seen again. In the end, after enough time had passed, that is, nobody minded, despite Sasha's protestations. Certainly in the short term there was activity, distress, the appearance of concern. But after not too long a time, Daniel Scheer became another of the city's missing persons, assumed to have wandered off to some other life, some other place. Sasha disputed this version for quite a long time. After all, she knew there was no way out of that costume, not without someone else's help. But even Sasha let it go in the end. Life hummed on. And the ancient bear went back to the Gramercy Costume and Novelty Store, down to the uninsured basement, where it hung on a rail in its bespoke canvas bag. It still hangs there today.
Mike Sengalo was reading The Bear by Jeremy Dyson. The programme was abridged and produced by Gemma Jenkins. Well, a very warm welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall in London. Susie Klein with you live on Radio 3 for this evening's prom, given by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales under their principal conductor, Thierry Fisher. And next for you on the musical menu, well, the table is laid, but not necessarily with anything you'd want to eat. A Table of Noises is a percussion concerto by the orchestra's composer in association, Simon Holt. It was written for tonight's soloist, Colin Curry. First heard a couple of years ago when it was commissioned by the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra. And tonight, A Table of Noises receives its London premiere. The title of the work was inspired by Simon Holt's great-uncle, Ashworth Hutton, who was a taxidermist. Well, Ashworth was severely crippled, so he needed the tools of his trade close to hand. His parlour table became the home for the various things he needed, and it's this object that gave the concerto its title. The music is in 10 movements. Some of them refer to Ash's macabre business, so there's some creepy names here. A drawer full of eyes and under glass, for example. There are also sections where the soloist is entirely absent. Instead, the music's inhabited by spectral figures, what Simon Holt calls ghosts, and these ghosts make visits throughout the piece. Well, the work's a truly collaborative effort in which Colin Curry had considerable output. I caught up with both Simon Holt and Colin earlier today, and I began by asking Simon to tell me more about Uncle Ashworth.
He would shoot at neighbours' cats. He would shoot at just about anything. And there's a lovely photo of him with a brace of hairs over his arm, and he was very much a man of the country. There was kingfishers under glass in his front room, and the heads of foxes on blocks on his wall, and whatever needed stuffing, he would stuff it.
And Colin, this tabletop, you're required to do quite a lot of physical work in this piece, aren't you?
I have on the tabletop a variety of sounds. Some of them are quite small. There's a very tiny, high-pitched chime, which is very difficult to hit in exactly the right place. It's quite tricky to operate, if you like. There's a log drum, there's the bottle, of course, which references ash, wood blocks, a brake drum, various cymbals, but slightly strange-sounding cymbals, slightly trashy sounds. And then I have a variety of things which I play with my feet. Pedal cowbell, pedal klaxon, which is real toad of toad hall thing. And then two hi-hat cymbals, which operate with my feet. I'm sitting on a cajon, which is a present from Simon. It's a lovely instrument.
It's a flamenco instrument. Uh-huh. It's like a drawer. Cajon means draw in Spanish, and they sit on it. And it has guitar strings in it, so it rattles.
It's a lovely bass sound. It sounds fantastic. So it's my job to make these things sound decent, if you like, especially in the tabletop movement, where the idea is that we only really have three sounds at once, and they gradually move round and introduce a new sound one at a time, more or less. So the whole thing should sound quite integrated, quite organic. I'm extremely excited about the very first six beats of the piece, because they're very sharp, very brittle, and they have a short silence after them. So that will be an amazing start to this piece. This tiny sort of fanfare, kick the piece off, followed by a couple of moments to hear it echo around the space. It's an enjoyable piece. Bits of it are quite witty, and there's moments of extreme
violence, right?
Yeah, violence and kind of madness, but
there's serene moments too. All sorts.
It does leave you something very special for the heart.
Colin Currie and Simon Holt talking to me earlier today. And here comes Colin Currie with tonight's conductor Thierry Fisher joining BBC National Orchestra of Wales for the London premiere of Simon Holt's A Table of Noises.
Thank you. Thank you.
a table of noises, written by Simon Holt, especially for tonight's soloist, the formidably talented Colin Curry. And given its London premiere here at the Proms by conductor Thierry Fisher and the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, their leader, Leslie Hatfield. Warm hug of congratulations now between Simon Holt and Colin Curry. Fantastic warmth between the two of them. They worked, as we said, very closely together on this piece. Not so closely that Simon Holt was prepared to share everything, though. He told me earlier today that there are several figures from his past, long gone in reality, who hover around. Nobody knows who they are, not even Colin. Well, Simon Holt is composer in association with tonight's orchestra. His appointment began a couple of years ago. BBC National Orchestra of Wales premiered his work Troubled Light here at the Proms. That was also with Thierry Fisher. Since then, Simon's written a brand new work for the inauguration of the orchestra's new home in Cardiff, Hodnot Hall. Next season, a new double concerto on the cards. Center Omaki, I believe it's called, the clarinet flugelhorn. That's going to be here on Radio 3 in November, performance on 3. Who knows, it may even end up one day at the Proms in due course, we hope. And a bow from Simon Holt, Colin Curry, and tonight's conductor, Thierry Fisher. Well, I have to say, I think it takes a brave composer to write as quietly as Simon Holt does for percussion. He told me earlier that he'd originally gone over to Colin Curry's house just to get a sense of what Colin could do, messing around with various instruments. He suddenly got the idea of writing almost an anti-percussion concerto, looking at the expressive possibilities of these instruments. It's not, Simon told me, about just bashing the percussion as loudly as possible. This piece is about finding a more atmospheric role for the soloist. So, finally on the bill this evening, music by Richard Strauss, his symphonic poem, Till Eulenspiegel's Merry Pranks. Till is a chronic joker, a legendary, mythic figure dating back to the 15th century. He turns up all over German folklore in a variety of different guises. In this version, Till is a visionary, a man who bucks conventions and trends in a bid to stand alone from the establishment. But he ends up paying the ultimate price for his heroism, and he's sentenced to death. The choice of story was very much a deliberate one. This was early in Strauss's career. His first opera, Guntram, had got, shall we say, less than favourable reviews. But this piece wasn't just a retort to the music critics. It was also an opportunity for Strauss to showcase and develop his brilliant abilities as an orchestrator. The writing is kaleidoscopic. There are effects that shift suddenly between different instrumental groups. It's almost a kind of mini concerto for orchestra. One of the most challenging parts is an opening flourish for solo horn. Well, earlier today, I caught up with Principal Horn of the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, Tim Thorpe. I asked him about the joys and the challenges of playing Strauss, particularly after a whole weekend of playing here at the Proms.
Yeah, a roast-up, I think we call it, really. We did Just Seven on Thursday, and then Doctor Who as well. Great fun to do, but again, very, you know, great for the brass, but it's constantly on your face, on top of Ride of the Valkyries and everything else. So, yeah, I mean, it's been fun, but yes, very tiring.
I wanted to talk to you particularly about Strauss. It's a bit of a challenge. Can you just outline for us what the role in the piece is and why it's a tricky one?
Well, it's Eulenspiegel. He was a bit of a trickster. So I think the horn takes on the role, or certainly starts the role off, as being a bit cheeky and a bit naughty. It's in 6/8, but then it's not on the beat, so you never quite know where you're actually sort of, you know, starting. You can't tap along to it, really.
The opening of this piece, I understand, is a kind of test piece for horn players everywhere because it is so tricky. Is it the technical issues? Is it the intervals? Is it the... What is it about this particular extract that makes it challenging?
Well, you know, it's an audition favourite, really. It's always used in auditions anywhere you go, from college all the way through the profession. I suppose it's the range, because it starts in the middle of the range on the French horn and then goes fairly high and then finishes off fairly low as well.
It's just a real showpiece for the orchestra, this. I mean, you start them off and then everybody's sort of flying, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's got some great roles all over the place. I mean, one of my favourite bits is the E-flat clarinet bit at the end, because he just goes bonkers, really. It's very good fun to play, but hopefully we're all feeling fresh enough by then to do it.
Tim Thorpe, the principal horn with the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, who will be playing that legendary solo in Till Eulenspiegel just a couple of minutes' time. And at the helm will be tonight's conductor, Thierry Fischer. What's the appeal of Strauss's score for him?
In general, in Strauss music, what I am very attracted to is this champagne feeling, you know, with different texture of sound everywhere. Lots of actions, you know, the woodwind playing one action, the strings another one, an extreme character in the percussion. And, you know, really, one thing I think about when I think Richard Strauss is champagne, and especially this piece. You want, at the same time, to laugh a lot and cry 6 bars later, because the character of Till, you know, all this death sentence in the end and all the provocation, you know, with his horse and the cymbal and the schnarl, we say in German, and everything, you know, it's all provocation, and it goes through the music. It's very inspiring to conduct this different character, to go from one extreme character to another in a few seconds, and in the end it's absolutely dramatic.
And it's interesting that you say champagne, because it's that sense of fizz and energy that you always get in a Strauss score, but also that this composer loves making the orchestra work hard for their money. They have to be real virtuosi to play.
You're absolutely right. It's extreme virtuose, Strauss in general, and this piece in particular, you know, so much. And it has to be played with virtuosity and delicacy, you know, because sometimes it's very soft. You have long lines taking from each other, starts in the low basses, you know, and goes up to the violin, piccolo taking over and everything. So you need at the same time full involvement without thinking and a lot of control of the orchestra technique.
With a piece like this, that's a well-known piece, an absolute core part of the repertoire, where does your performance start as a conductor? Where do you start with an interpretation?
First of all, especially conducting BBC Wales, which is an orchestra I know rather well, in a concert, I am trusting them a lot. And it's one of these pieces when you can say, okay, it's up to you guys, you know. And actually the job of conductor, the way I see it for such a piece, is to trust them, just giving a few indications and let the band, you know, go with madness. It's not the same if you do contemporary music like the Holt concerto we played before, or Schumann, you know, or classical music. Well, a lot is about the energy of the conductor, you know, and the concept and the way you rehearse. But Richard Strauss and Till, you know, you can say, good luck, you know, let's enjoy. It's really a very different feeling than all the composers.
This orchestra has had to get to grips with an awful lot of music for these 4 days or so of performances at the Proms. Talk us through the range of what they've had to do and how it's gone.
I am full of admiration for the orchestra. I think that the 10 last days with the rehearsals in Cardiff, the orchestra played so many different pieces in a huge variety of repertoire, from Verdi Requiem to Doctor Who to Shostakovich, Schumann, Cherubini, Holt, Strauss, Prokofiev. I mean, absolutely unbelievable. And it was a very fruitful period for us. I mean, exhausting for the players, for concentration. But I mean, it shows the qualities of the band, you know, being able to go from, you know, extreme repertoire in so many pieces in a few days. And I think we are at the end today from a very, very busy period. That's why what I said about Strauss, it would be a good sibling just to let it go and just enjoy the 20 last minutes as much as we can as a group.
Thierry Fischer talking to me earlier today. So, Till Eulenspiegel, the piece opens with a kind of once upon a time introduction, and then we are off with Till's tongue-in-cheek musical motto. We heard Tim Thorpe talking about it earlier, that's the solo horn part. That theme pops up throughout the piece as Till embarks on his wild adventures. He argues with peasants, he rails at preachers, he tries and fails to woo a beautiful girl, and mocks the intelligentsia for that. Just read the music critics who've been terrible about his first opera. At the end, Till is brought before a panel of judges. They review his career, they sentence him to death. But even then, he can't resist departing from this world without a final cheeky wink. The whole thing ends up in a glorious blaze of colour. So here comes tonight's conductor, Thierry Fischer, to conduct his orchestra, the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, in Till Eulenspiegel by Richard Strauss.
Thank you.
Till Eulenspiegel's Merry Pranks. The BBC National Orchestra of Wales under their principal conductor, Thierry Fisher. The leader, Leslie Hatfield. Well, this orchestra certainly has had to work hard recently. 10 days of relentless rehearsing, perfecting, performing. This is the fourth concert they've done here at the Proms since last Thursday. And they don't get much of a breather before they have to pack their bags and they are off for the Concertgebouw in Amsterdam. Two dates there next week. Applause here at the Royal Albert Hall for E-flat clarinet John Cooper. All the winds and brass on their feet, indeed the strings too, and Thierry Fisher enjoying the warm applause here of the audience. Well, I'll be back here at the Proms on Friday. BBC 4 television as Mark Elder introduces the first of this summer's youth orchestras all the way from Australia. That prom also live here on Radio 3. But for now, from all of us here at the Royal Albert Hall, time to hand you on for the rest of this evening's listening to Jonathan Swain.
Susie, thank you very much. Susie Klein there at the Royal Albert Hall. And just to say, another chance to hear tonight's prom again on Thursday afternoon at 2 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3. Also, if you'd like to submit a review of tonight's prom, just go to bbc.co.uk/proms and click on share. Well, tonight's prom isn't the only live event tonight here on Radio 3. Later on, Jazz on 3 comes live from the Manchester Jazz Festival, including music by Stuart McCallum and a quartet featuring pianist Gwilym Simcock. That's live Jazz on 3 starting at 11.15 this evening. As for the Radio 3 mornings...
Breakfast on Radio 3. Breakfast on Radio 3, bringing music to life. Weekday mornings from 7 till 10 here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, back to this evening, and in just over 5 minutes' time, the Lebrecht interview. Tonight, Norman Lebrecht talks to the American mezzo-soprano Marilyn Horn, tracing her career from a precocious Shirley Temple sound-alike to the major mezzo bel canto roles by Rossini, Bellini and Donizetti and others for which she was justly famed. That's at 9:15. Until then, music making from another mezzo, the Austrian Angelika Kirschlager. Here she is in songs by Korngold. Here it was Mahler recognised as something of a genius when Korngold was a mere 10 years old. And how like Mahler the first of these songs sounds. All of them Shakespeare settings. And Angelika Kirschlager here with pianist Helmut Deutsch.
Fly away, fly away, babe.
Hey Robin, ending those four of the Songs of the Clown, Opus 29, by Korngold. All of them Shakespeare settings from the late 1930s, and they were sung there by Angelika Kirschlager with pianist Helmut Deutsch. You're listening to BBC Radio 3. It's 9:15. Time now for the second in a new series of the Librecht interview with Norman Librecht.
Marilyn Horn is an American pioneer, a pathbreaker for American singers on European opera stages. From her 1960 debut in the stark role of Marie in Alban Berg's Wozzeck, Horn became the mezzo of choice in roles that ranged from the ultramodern to the Baroque to bel canto, with a strong preference for Rossini. Igor Stravinsky was one of her mentors, and her strongest stage partnership was with Joan Sutherland. Opera News, magazine of the Met, has called her possibly the most influential singer in American history. Behind the public figure is a woman of courage and resilience. Raised in the Great Depression and known as Jackie for her tomboy demeanor, she married, against great social pressure, a black musician, Henry Lewis, who became a successful conductor. Since retiring from the stage in 1996, she's run the Marilyn Horn Foundation, which gives recital and other opportunities to rising singers, among them Nicole Cabell and Lawrence Brownlee. The song, she likes to say, continues. Marilyn Horn, Jackie, you've still got a busier diary than most active singers. What drives you to keep working for people who want to sing?
I keep asking myself that. I'm not quite sure. It must be that I enjoy it, and I certainly enjoy being able to aid and abet young singers, help them along. I really like teaching very, very much. And because I do have so many contacts and friends in the world, I'm able to also help them in many other ways, pick up the phone and call somebody and maybe just say, so-and-so is auditioning for you today or tomorrow. Open up your ears, especially for this singer, because I think this singer is special. People call me and ask me if I could please cast their next Beethoven Ninth or Mozart Requiem or something like that, which I'm always delighted to do, because I have a long list of singers who've passed my way that I just, you know, have a great joy to recommend.
This informal, extracurricular, extramural activity that you take on, the masterclasses, the academies, the foundation, all of that, is that to fill a gap that you feel has opened out?
I'm not really sure, because I just sort of fell into all of it. I didn't really have a plan, to tell you the truth. I had not thought too much about teaching. In fact, I didn't even know if I could teach. Some friends have said to me, well, you're crazy. You've been teaching always, because, say, in a rehearsal, a young singer might be singing and I would walk up and say, why are you singing that like that? Or something lovely, you know. So when I was asked to take over the voice department duties at the Music Academy of the West in Santa Barbara, where I also went to school when I was 19, I said yes, and that just started the whole ball rolling. And then I just began to get asked to teach in many places. So what I'm ending up doing basically is traveling a lot, and I go to various music schools in universities or private and spend maybe a week teaching, a residency, shall we say, where I teach master classes, some closed to just only the students, some open to the public, and then lots of private lessons.
You must have a bigger Rolodex of young singers than the director of any opera house.
I really do.
You had voice training at 8 years old.
Oh, actually, earlier. I had started my first formal lessons at 5, which, of course, I don't recommend for anybody. But in my more mature years, I realized what it was all about. It was because of Shirley Temple. She was the big star of the movies in the Depression. And there was this little 3-year-old girl singing and dancing, and they didn't think anything about the fact that I could maybe do that too, since I obviously showed evidence of being able to sing very, very early.
And your parents thought you could end up as the next child sensation?
I think perhaps that might have been behind it. I wasn't, though.
But the family went to California, which is where stars are made.
Right.
Did they think you were going to be a movie star? Did you think you were going to be a movie star?
Never. They may have, but they didn't say it to me.
But you were also doing doo-wahs for Hollywood soundtracks.
But that happened when I was about 12. We started doing a lot of background music for the movies.
And the kids around you, the other people who are doing it, they probably all had their eyes set on the movies, whereas you were already focused on music?
I'm not sure. I, to tell you the truth, everybody was pretty much focused on singing. I can tell you that working in the movies was a marvelous way to earn money. That's one of the things that was a big attraction.
Was it also a marvelous way to learn music? There were a lot of really interesting people around.
Yes, there were, and I'm very fortunate that I had that experience. You know, now there are many books coming out about those years in Los Angeles where we had all basically the refugees from Hitler. Not necessarily in the movies, but there were a lot of wonderful people who worked in the movies, mostly men, of course, in the music end of it, the composing end of it. And I also had many teachers and coaches who had that same experience of coming from Europe.
Do you remember that also at school, that there were kids in your class who were perhaps refugees in the same ways that you'd been displaced?
Not so many. I can tell you what I definitely remember, because I lived in Long Beach, which is 16, 17 miles from the center of LA. And what we had, which was fascinating because we moved there just after the whole war was over, we had all of the Japanese students being released from the internment camps. That was very interesting. I didn't really realize how interesting it was at the time, but I definitely remember we had all of these students.
These were Japanese Americans?
Absolutely, yeah.
And they'd spent the war locked up?
The Japanese were interned in California during the war, and they came out and came to our schools. And we interacted, you know, like any other students. It was just fine. But that was interesting, you know, because I came from this small town in Pennsylvania that basically immigrants were there, but they were Italians or Polish or something like that. I hadn't experienced, first of all, almost zero blacks and Hispanics, forget that. We didn't have those either. And there was not a Japanese family that I know existed in that small town, about 10,000 people.
You were a product of the Californian melting pot.
I was, yes.
And you made what you now call pirate recordings, which are cover versions of pop hits.
Right.
You were imitating Peggy Lee in
Yes.
Lover When I'm Near You.
Yes, that's right. That was, again, all for money. Mm-hmm. By then, I was in university. I went to University of Southern California. And a friend of mine who was singing with me in a cappella choir and madrigal singer said, you know, I'm making these recordings and we could use you to be in the, I guess, backup music, you'd say, for $40 a session. That was a lot of money in 1951. So, again, it was a money deal, and I relied on my mimicry because I very quickly went from being backup music to being one of the soloists, and I have good ears for mimicking, and I used it. What can I tell you?
Did you never think this might be the easier option? Forget about opera. Why don't I go into becoming a pop singer? Why don't I become Lena Horne?
Our dear Lena, she just died.
Yeah.
Isn't that, I'm so sad. She was somebody that I greatly admired and I knew somewhat. Yeah, I'm sad that she's gone. She was a great, great artist.
She came to your first Carmen at the Met, didn't she?
Yes, she did. She certainly did. And I remember so many wonderful evenings hearing her in nightclubs and, you know, I guess one would call it cabaret now, mainly, and her incredible one-woman show on Broadway that was just staggering. But in any event, I did dabble with pop music because I could sing it. You know, the pop music of our day was singable. It's not like today's. And therefore, I did a lot of it. And yeah, I could have swung either way, but the music of classical music was definitely pulling me. That's I think, what it was all about in the end. Having the talent, but then also being able to live with all that great music.
The first Carmen you sang was voice track in the movie Carmen Jones.
That's right.
With Dorothy Dandridge and Harry Belafonte.
Right.
Did you think that was a good idea, turning grand opera into soap and pop?
I thought it was fine. You know, I thought it was fine. Also, if you ever make a study, Norman, of the lyrics that Hammerstein wrote, they're ingenious.
I saw it at 16. I was bowled over. I hadn't seen a Carmen in the Opera House. I thought it was great.
You saw the movie?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay. And I was 20 when I did it. Again, it was this thing of making money. I was at university and I needed every dollar I could get to pay for my lessons and everything else. And a friend of mine said, they're hiring white people to sing in the soundtrack and we can make a lot of money. And I said, great, I'm going to go audition. And so I called and got an audition. But unfortunately, or fortunately, they sent me to the wrong audition. They sent me to the audition where people were auditioning to be the singers, to dub the voices of the actors. And I sang Micaela Zarya in French. That was my audition piece. But again, I was sitting there listening to the other ladies sing, and they were, a lot of them, singing the Hammerstein version of the Habanera. And I've never been shy about putting myself forward. I just said, you know, I can sing low too. And the wonderful conductor Herschel Gilbert said to me, would you like to sing the Habanera? And I said, well, I've never sung it, but I know it for sure. And he said, can you just read the Hammerstein lyrics? I said, sure. And that was that. And within very short order, they asked me to come in the next day, I think it was, and do a little more singing for the role of Carmen. That was a surprise, though. I didn't expect that.
In college, you met the Vienna legend Lotte Lehmann, and a philanthropist paid her to give you lessons. Was she rough on you?
Not in the beginning. I think my first gig with her was a master class at USC, and I remember I sang my very first German Lied. I was 17, and it was Die junge Nonne of Schubert. And she was fine, and I did more classes with her. Later on, when I was at the Music Academy in Santa Barbara with her, she let fly on me one day. And
what did she say?
Well, she just really badly criticized my German, and I'm sure that it needed criticizing, but not in the way she did it. And I learned a lesson that day. I didn't think about it at the time, to tell you the truth, but somewhere the seed was planted that if I ever did public master classes, I would never be that hard on a student in public.
She told you also that if you want to be an opera singer, you don't have children.
Oh, yes, that was another time, yes. And that was, I was already pregnant. She could be a tough lady, there's no question about that. She heard somebody say, Jackie, I hear you're pregnant. And I wasn't showing, I guess, too much at that time. I said, yes. And she turned around and this other person said, what do you want, a boy or a girl? And I said, I don't care, I want a healthy baby. And she said, and I am not exaggerating this, she said, well, I hope it'll be a Null. And she said, spoke to me in German. And we know that Null means nothing because singers shouldn't have children. Well, I can tell her wherever she is, she was wrong. Because also you have a wonderful baby and child and grown up, and then you have grandchildren, which is the glory of your old age.
While we're on memory lane, Jackie, how did you get to meet Stravinsky?
We have a wonderful organization in Los Angeles. It was originally called Evenings on the Roof and then became known as the Monday Evening Concerts, where basically new music and really old music were the foundation of these concerts.
You were singing madrigals.
Madrigals and also solos, absolutely, soloists, yeah. Mm-hmm. By then, you see, it was in my late teens, and I was beginning to be known as a dependable singer around town in Los Angeles. So I was being called to come and sing lots of concerts. So that's how it happened. And this particular one was the music of Stravinsky. And I worked it with him. And he actually taught me my very first Russian. They were some Russian folk songs of his. And the relationship grew from then. And then I worked very closely with his assistant at the time, Robert Kraft. We did lots of Gesualdo madrigals. I lay claim to having recorded 65 Gesualdo madrigals and motets. And also things like the Monteverdi Vespers, singing that. That was a big deal because I don't think it had ever been performed in Los Angeles. That was the kind of rep that we did in those concerts.
Isn't there something that Stravinsky said about you? He said, the good Lord knows everything, but Jackie knows better.
I don't think he said that, but, you know, it got quoted. You know, I always remember with John Huston, and he said whether you should do the legend or you should do what's true. And he said, go with the legend every time.
There was also a story that you told Hindemith that he didn't understand Baroque style.
I don't think I ever did that. I remember it was fun. I was asked to sing with him at the first time in Vienna, and we got to know each other. And Gesualdo was one of the first things that I did with him. And he was amazed to find out that I already knew the madrigals. And then we talked about another piece of Monteverdi's, and he said that he wanted to do that, which I did with him in concert. And I said, I've already sung this. And he was just, where did you do all of this? I said, at the University of Southern California.
And he couldn't believe that an American, let alone a Californian, could do these things.
I think that was probably part of it, but the fact that I was up front and cheeky enough to say, but I know these songs already.
It was Stravinsky's assistant, Robert Kraft, who helped you go to Europe after your father died in 1956.
Well, no, that's not quite accurate either. Okay. Sorry to...
No, keep correcting the legend.
I got myself to Europe. That was... Okay. I had decided before my father died, actually, because he died suddenly, I had already decided that that was going to be my road. Now, we're talking about 1956, mm-hmm. and the German opera houses were very, very interesting to aspire to in those days because of the fact there were so many of them and we didn't have them in the United States. You know, in those days, we just barely had some regional companies in the United States. It was very different. So if you really wanted to get your opera legs from the ground up, you really sort of had to go there. And again, I had all these teachers who had come out of that system and recommended it very, very highly to me. And as a matter of fact, at the time, I was offered a contract to go to the New York City Opera, and I turned it down because I guess I had been brainwashed enough, or I, you know, actually did have some smarts and thought this would be the better route for me. I never, ever regretted it. It was really the best kind of experience anyone can get.
And you did 4 years hard ground in provincial Gelsenkirchen.
I did 3 years there. I did a year studying in Vienna. Mm-hmm. Hard grind. But again, you know, if you're enjoying what you're doing, that makes it much less hard.
And in 1960, you make the breakthrough as Marie in Wozzeck. That's a pretty dangerous role to go with. Tough on you, tough on the audience.
You know...
None of the German girls in the house was prepared to put their hands up and say, we'll do it?
Well, I don't think they were asked to. You know, you were assigned what you were supposed to sing. Mm-hmm. And when you were under a fest contract like that. Mm-hmm. And I was assigned Marie, and I actually was terrified of it because one always had heard this kind of thing is a voice breaker. And I had sung enough of Schoenberg and Webern and that kind of music with Robert Kraft and other people in Los Angeles that I knew how difficult it was. I do not have absolute pitch, and that is a liability, actually, when you're going to sing 12-tone music. But I had been experienced in it. And at the time, I told my music director that I didn't want to do it because I thought it was a voice breaker, as we say. And he was quite insistent. I don't think we argued or anything, but I made him a deal. I don't even know if it would have held up, but I said, I'll learn the first scene. And if I feel that I can sing it without killing myself, I'll do it. My agent in Vienna told me if I did it, he wouldn't manage me anymore. A lot of people said, you're too young, you're too blah, blah, blah.
You were 25. You know,
I was 26 at the time.
Okay.
I learned that first scene and I thought, well, this feels pretty good. This doesn't seem to tax me beyond my vocal resources, and started to learn the rest of it. And I said, okay, I'll do it. I went against a lot of heavy tide, but I felt somehow that it was just really right for me. And boy, was I right.
From the age of 17, you'd been seeing Henry Lewis on and off. He was a double bass player in the Los Angeles Philharmonic. He was a year older than you. And nobody wanted you to marry him because he was black. What was it your mother said? She said, go and be his mistress, don't marry him.
Oh, right, yes, absolutely. She did say that, which is quite astounding for somebody like my mother, who came out of a white bread small town in Pennsylvania, Protestant ethic, the whole thing, to even consider that someone should live in sin rather than be married.
And Roger Wagner, your chorus director, said if you married a black man, you were finished in America.
That's right, he did. That my career would be over. I hate the word career, but I can't think of a better one. I had a lot of lovely advice like that, but they were all wrong. It's amazing.
You must have been pretty sure of yourself.
Oh,
to
yes.
Resist all of that.
Sure, but also unsure. That's what was difficult, was going ahead with what I really wanted to do in marrying Henry, but feeling all of those doubting voices in my head. That was not easy. That gave me some unsteady moments, but he was the object of my affections.
Were you prepared for the prejudice that you'd face afterwards, the looks that you got, perhaps in the southern states, places you couldn't go together?
We didn't go there together.
Just didn't go.
No. I'm not even sure that we did that as a rule. It was a question that I was basically only going to the southern states to sing recitals, and that was by myself with my accompanist. So we weren't in those places. I was prepared, yes. I expected it, and it was never really as bad as I expected, and I think that's because we were in showbiz, and showbiz people are generally much more open-minded to anything that's controversial. So that made it a lot easier. And my mother came around after a couple of weeks. She realized that she had made a very big mistake by not attending our wedding, and apologized to me and said it was a big mistake, the whole, for on her part. But, I understood her. She thought her world was also going to come crashing around her. And that was that.
And Henry Lewis's career took off pretty much at the same time as yours.
Right, right. He had gone into the Los Angeles Philharmonic as a player when he was only 16. And that was already a tremendously big deal. He was like we would say the Jackie Robinson of classical music, because there wasn't another black player in a major symphony in the United States at that time.
Wow. That's the sort of thing that we forget. He was the first black player in any American symphony orchestra.
That's right.
And then Zubin Mehta made him assistant conductor.
Yeah, that's right. Zubin was made the music director after there was a debacle with George Schulte.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that? Did you ever hear about it?
Yep.
Yeah. And
heard it from Schulte. He turned up. He'd found they'd made another appointment without consulting him, and he got on the first flight home.
Right, right. I'll never forget one night, several years later, many, many years later, actually, I had just done a concert with Zubin with the Philharmonic. By the way, Zubin is somebody I totally adore and have for 50 years. And afterwards, there was a party, a small dinner party, and we were sitting around this table, and the woman who did all the hiring and firing in those days was a lady named Dorothy Chandler, whose husband owned the Los Angeles Times. And she's the one who hired Zubin as George's associate conductor. And we were speaking about the fact that she'd very much liked astrology, and she followed Carol Reiter, that was his name. And she said, that's where I saw that I should hire Zubin as Schulte's assistant. And I said, my mouth sometimes gets the better of me, and I said, better you should have consulted Schulte.
And then he went on to turn the New Jersey Symphony into
right.
a top flight orchestra.
Yeah, yeah.
When he was music director in New Jersey, it can't have been easy for you, being a conductor's wife as well as a famous singer, having to do the chores of greeting the patrons, attending the premieres?
Well, I did the best I could. I probably didn't do as well as I could because most of my observances have shown me over my long life now is that conductors really need their wives to be sort of secretary and nurse and dresser and assistant and all kinds of things like that. So I was not able to fill those roles very well. I was dealing with my own career, and as you can imagine, you have to put an awful lot of time and preparation in when you reach a certain level.
Was that one of the problems that contributed to the ending of the marriage? That you just you were going in those different directions?
It could have been a bit of it. One thing I can tell you, it never had to do with race, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we just grew apart like a lot of marriages do. But we remained very, very good friends. And we had a daughter, and you have to do that when you have a child. Not everybody does, I do know that, but we were able to, and we used to joke that we had a failed divorce.
After you had your daughter, was it then that the voice dropped from High Marie to Middle Range Rossini?
Not really. It's just that it seemed like I was getting into a repertory that nobody else could sing. Enjoying it very, very much. And I think that, again, this fate, or, you know, destino, whatever you want to call it, stepped in because I was asked to audition to sing with Joan.
Joan Sutherland.
Right, of course. And it became obvious that there was a lot of repertory that she was performing that I could probably do the other part. And we just sort of calculated in a way that maybe this is where I belong. Maybe this is what I was meant to do. I do think that my voice was settling a little bit, but this was also nothing new since the time I was about 15 or 16, people would hear my voice and they'd say, "Are you sure you're not a mezzo?" And I'd say, "Oh, no, I'm a soprano." Because I had an easy top and I had it, you know, since I was a child, and I didn't think twice about it. But I was involved in singing a lot of mezzo music, but it just was crazy time, you know. It was just me sort of singing everything. I had some kind of smarts with knowing what I should not sing, but singing lower music was not one of them. But remember, I was not singing Azucena, and I was not singing Amneris. I wasn't singing things like that. Mm-hmm. I was singing Nigra Sum in the Monteverdi Vespers.
In years to come, quizmasters will ask which American mezzo-soprano sang with Judy Garland but never with Maria Callas. There's only going to be one answer, isn't there?
Well, we were at a party one night and ended up in a room that was all red, ceiling, carpet, bedspreads, everything, sitting in the middle of the floor singing together. You know, it was fun. I was a little tipsy. I don't think she was, but I was. And so I was able to just sit there and enjoy it all.
And what were you singing?
She was making up a song. She was singing Louis B, Louis C, Louis D, Louis E, Louis F, Louis G. I think she meant Louis B. Mayer, but and then we went on to singing other pop songs together.
You were a huge admirer of Callas, but you never sang with her.
No, I never did. I really missed my opportunity. I listened to an agent that I had at the time who I had a lot of recitals booked in not very important places, but places in the United States. And I was asked if I would come and sing Adalgisa with her in Paris, her last Norma's. My agent said, "Oh, you can't do that. You're booked." I was very stupid. I should have swum the Atlantic to do that. But I listened to my agent and fulfilled my engagements.
How different was she, do you think, from Joan Sutherland? You knew how easily you could work with Joan.
I'm going to throw that back at you.
Go on.
How different do you think they were, Norman?
Oh, chalk and cheese, obviously. Obviously. But, I mean, you'd settled into that pattern of working with a fellow Anglophone who was Joan Sutherland, who was of even temperament, whereas with Callas it would have been much more exciting.
Well, I think I was definitely drawn to that aspect of Callas, for sure, to you know, really get into the words, and especially in the recitatives are so terribly important for me, and they were, I think, for Callas too, maybe a little less for Joan. I wouldn't like to say that, but it's possible. And I liked very much her temperament, and yeah, you know, we know she had her vocal flaws, but she was... what do I have to... Come on, the world knows who Callas was.
Which of the men did you enjoy working with?
Come on, I loved singing with Luciano.
Sure.
What's not to love, right?
I was just going to say, I just saw on YouTube a clip of you singing Verdi Requiem in Milano with Abbado, must have been about 1970, and Luciano, very young.
Right.
Sitting behind you and looking up at you in frank amazement.
Really?
Absolutely wonderful, yeah.
I must watch that. well, Luciano, you know, that was something else. I don't have to talk about him either. Everybody knows what it was. But I have to say, for my own self, I still get a catch in my throat when I hear his voice on the radio or on discs or YouTube. The sound of that voice, it makes me very sad still. And to think that we shared the same disease, that also, you know, at the end of his life, we were not only sharing music, but we were sharing pancreatic cancer.
Yeah. Just coming back to La Scala, you had a celebrated moment there with Beverly Sills when there were two Americans who were going on stage, and as far as you saw it, there was only going to be one.
Well, it was just a question of the machinations that were taking place with her press team. And the people at La Scala were very kind and nice to me. And I'd already been there because I made my actual debut in Oedipus Rex, which I thought was kind of fun to make my debut there in one of the great works of Stravinsky. Mm-hmm. And then went on to sing The Siege of Corinth of Rossini, and Beverly was part of the cast. But the Scala people said her press agent is coming up to the press room where all the pictures and things are, and choosing everything that's going to the periodicals like New York Times and Time Magazine, etc., etc., and he's leaving you out. And I couldn't take that.
So what did
you
do?
I just went into her dressing room very shortly before the curtain opened and told him that if my picture did not appear in the New York Times, I would come to his office and smash him in the face. That was the opening. But it had to do with machinations, as I said, which were going on behind the scenes, that's all. But, you know, Beverly was seizing her moment to become a super-duper pooper star, and that's the way it goes in this profession. But I did not want to be pushed against the wall.
I think you said at the time a singer has to look after herself.
I think that's pretty much it, and it still holds.
Did conductors give you much trouble?
Occasionally, oh yes, especially with the Rossini. The mm-hmm. Rossini was very difficult because the conductors did not want to, at that time, allow any kind of ornaments and embellishments to the music, which of course, with Richard Bonning and with Henry and myself and Joan, we had all done a lot of research on this, and we knew that the performance practices in the days of Rossini was quite different. That the reason why those cavatinas and cavalettas were written twice was the second time you better come around and show off what you can do. And so there, I had a lot of trouble with this. It seemed to always, you know.
Anyone in particular?
Well, even down to Abbado, whom I absolutely adored, and we'd sung quite a bit together, and I had problems with the conductor at the Met. His name is Gabor Utrich. He was hired to do the new production of Italiana there, and I started to rehearse, and he was fairly insulting, and I just said, you know what, I don't think we're going to be able to do this together, and I just closed my book and said goodbye. I walked out, which... Having had this happen already several times, I was prepared with a contract that said, the version, that's how we put it, the version will be in agreement with Miss Horn. And At that time, we had for a very short time, Raphael Kubelik was our general music director, and he was the one that chose Maestro Utrecht to conduct the opera. And it came down to reading the contract, basically. And I'll never forget when he came in opening night to me and said, well, you see, everything works out. Everything's going to be peace and love and light and all of that. I said, yeah, but it would not have been without that contract. Okay. And, you know, you get a little jaded about things like that, but you are prepared. So I'm switching.
So you walked out and you walked back in and you said you'd do it my way.
Yeah, I don't think I used those words, but I was certainly adamant that I did it my way or the highway. And then I'll fast forward to La Scala when I went to sing it there. They already had had a very successful production there with Berganza in the role of Isabella in Italiana. And because Claudio and I shared the same management, he didn't feel comfortable with putting that clause in the contract for La Scala. And I said, oh, God, here we go again. But I let it go because I had sung with Abbado, Oedipus Rex, and done concerts with him and things like Mahler and evenings with other music. But I went to the first of all, I took great pains to copy all of my embellishments and send them to him, so that he would know exactly what he was dealing with. Well, you know, we sat in a rehearsal, and everybody else was present, and I knew that the eyes were on me, the American singer. It always was that way when you were very much the foreigner in those days. And, oh, well, here were the comments. I don't like that. No, you shouldn't do that. And I just stopped. I said, you know what, Claudio? I do think that you and I should be alone first before we rehearse the rest of the opera. Again, he didn't want to do it. And I said, I sent you all of my ornaments and embellishments. And he just started striking them out. And I said, you know what? I don't want to do it if I can't do it in a way that I've really worked it out and think is correct. So I went again to a hotel room and said, I'm out of here on the first plane tomorrow morning. And the flowers started to arrive from the sovrintendente and from various other people. And Claudio said, okay. And we had wonderful performances. Of course, the great thing was the reviews that came out that said, up to now we've had Mozart, now we have Rossini.
How did you get on with Leonard Bernstein?
Very well, very well. You know, there's a certain thing about coming from the same land and understanding sort of deep down what it's all about to be an American in this case. And I think that we shared too. But Lenny always used to say to me, and I take this as a great, great compliment, that Lenny said, you do things musically before I tell you to do them. I think of it and you've already done it, that kind of thing. And he had such great ability to teach also and to instruct. And you couldn't have a meal with Lenny without learning something. It was a wonderful, great, great collaboration.
The foundation that you've set up has presented more than 100 new singers and reached 50,000 children across the United States. What are you aiming for? What's the goal?
Well, the first aim was for me when I decided to set up the foundation. I was facing my 60th birthday, and I said, you know, I think it's time for me to start giving back big time because I've had such a wonderful life in music. I decided that the place that I saw where it was needed was recitals because they were becoming fewer and far between in the United States.
So you're trying to fix a broken infrastructure?
Yeah, I've trying very, very hard. What I succeeded in doing, I think, was creating a foundation that got a very fine reputation for doing really, really good, solid work and becoming quite well known throughout the country for people who loved recitals, wanted to sing recitals. And I created a real interest for lots of young singers. I do know that they wanted very much to be a part of it. But what has happened is we are now being absorbed into Carnegie Hall and will no longer be the Marilyn Horne Foundation. We will be the Marilyn Horne Legacy at Carnegie Hall, and we are going to be a part of their Weill Institute, which is for children's concerts, local recitals. See, we didn't just perform for children. That was part of the outreach. We were there really performing for the public, and we had these residencies in various cities throughout the country. We were the only foundation that was dedicated only to singing.
Is it harder for young singers, young American singers today, than it was when you were growing up in the Great Depression?
I think it's more difficult in many, many ways because of certain other requirements. And now we are dealing with HD, and that is making an enormous change in opera. Look, I happen to think that television ruined our lives, basically. And now we have the internet. It's just like a monster there in front of us. And YouTube, and people have so much...
So how does opera and singing survive in this environment?
I don't know. To tell you the truth, I'm really... The way it's going to survive is that there will always be voices coming along who want to sing it. That's for sure. And I hear them all the time. I'm constantly hearing auditions, especially for my school in Santa Barbara. We listened live to 573 singers this year to take 23 places. So I hear the voices coming all the time. But the question is how they're going to be used. I don't have to go into, you know, you write about this all the time anyway, you know, the kinds of productions that they're being asked to perform in and the kinds of physical attributes that are now becoming quite necessary because HD has really come on so strong. And I have many friends who live in different cities that love it. They wouldn't miss one of those broadcasts.
All they want to see is opera on television, but not in the opera house anymore because they can't see it live enough.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. Well, you know, I happen to go to the Met a lot, first of all, because I live in New York, but I also live a block from where the Met is, so I go there, hear lots of things. And I must say, a lot of the things that are very successful on HD are not so successful in the live performances. They're very different. A lot of people you can't hear very well. And that's the thing that's disturbing me the most.
And I've seen directors who watched their first night performances from the television truck outside rather than from the house.
Absolutely, no question about it.
How do you tell singers to contend with this? They can't have a Marilyn Horne clause in their contract anymore. How do they resist these onslaughts on their integrity?
Well, I tell you, they'll have to do what I did before I could get a clause, right? You have to figure out how you can survive in the situation. Maybe they have to do some dumb things on stage, but they'll have to do it until they get some modicum of control. You know, well, I can't do that, or I don't want to do that, or I won't do that. Not everybody gets the control. We know that, too. But I have to still, in my position as a teacher and as certainly a promoter and helper of young singers, I have to still teach them in the way that I was brought up, to get their voices having a wonderful technique that will sail out in the hall, whatever size it is. I have to still teach that. I can't teach while you're going to be on a microphone. I have to go for the straight old singing principles. We can call it bel canto if you want to, how the 19th century singers were trained. I do have to go for that.
You've had a real struggle with pancreatic cancer.
I did.
And you faced it as you faced everything openly with great transparency.
I was very lucky that guardian angel was around again. I just really have done great. It's been 4.5 years since I was diagnosed, and I just knock on wood every day, but I'm still here.
Marilyn Horne, thank you very much.
Norman, great to talk to you. Thanks so much for having me.
Marilyn Horne was talking to Norman Lebrecht. And don't forget the programme's available to listen to again on the Radio 3 website. You can also download it as a podcast at bbc.co.uk/podcasts. Well, next Monday evening at the later time of 9:45, Norman Lebrecht will be in conversation with the conductor Simone Young. That's next Monday evening, 9:45, here on BBC Radio 3.
a celebration of the genius of Stephen Sondheim. An amazing cast perform songs from some of his best-loved shows with the BBC Concert Orchestra and conductor David Charles Abell.
Well, Stephen Sondheim creates a unique sound world for each of his musicals. I mean, for Little Night Music, it's the world of the Viennese Waltz. For Sweeney Todd, it's sort of shock horror movie music. And for Company, it's 70s contemporary sound. It's going to be a joy to create all those worlds with the BBC Concert Orchestra, which is the ideal instrument to do all those different styles.
Sondheim at 80 in the BBC Proms, Saturday evening at 7:30 here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, back to tonight, and Jazz on 3 tonight comes live from the Manchester Jazz Festival, including music by Stuart McCallum and a quartet featuring pianist Gwilym Simcock. That's live Jazz on 3, starting at 11:15 this evening. Before it at 11, the start of a new week of the essay. Music might feature in the work of a good many writers, but do that many writers actually play an instrument? More than you might think. And this week's essay series charts 5 writers with musical careers, so to speak, and how playing relates to their lives as writers. They're also keen to demonstrate their musical talents, which you can hear at the end of each essay. Novelist Patrick Gale begins the series tonight with his recollections.